Okay. Good evening, everybody. It's good to see everybody. Hope everyone had an enjoyable week. Just one brief thought before we jump into the drasha. I'm not sure if you had a chance to see the inauguration yesterday. Just a thought running through my mind yesterday, maybe I appreciate it more this year than other years, is just historically to appreciate the beauty of a peaceful transition of power is majestic. I found it to be just, no matter who one may or may not have voted for, but just to be able to appreciate that peaceful transition is a beautiful thing and something to appreciate, even in the year 2020. It's just a short thought. But now to Parshas Bo. So here we go. A shepherd boy tended his master's sheep near a dark forest, not far from the village. However, he soon found life in the pasture very dull. So one day he thought to himself, I need to find a way to amuse myself. His master had told him to call for help should a wolf attack the flock, and that way villagers would drive away the wolf. So now, though he had not seen a wolf, he ran toward the village shouting on top of his lungs, "Wolf! Wolf!" As he expected, the villagers who heard the cry dropped their work and in great excitement ran to the pasture. When they got there, all they found was the boy doubled up with laughter at the trick he played on them. A few days later, the shepherd boy once again was bored, so he shouted again, "Wolf! Wolf!" And once again, the villagers all ran to help the boy, only to be laughed at. Then, one fateful evening, as the sun was setting behind the forest and the shadows were creeping out over the pasture, a wolf, a real wolf, sprung from the underbrush and fell upon the sheep. In terror, the boy ran to the village, shouting, "Wolf! Wolf!" But though the villagers heard him, they did not run to help him. As they said, "He cannot fool us," as he had before. And to the boy's dismay, the wolf killed the entire flock of sheep. The Boy Who Cried Wolf, a classic from Aesop's Fables. I remember as a young boy listening to the story with one thought running through my head. I can't believe the villagers even came to help the second time. The boy had deliberately lied to them for his own amusement. If I was a villager, there's no way I would have come running again after being lied to and tricked the first time. Fool me once, shame on you, but fool me twice, shame on me. And I most certainly would not have been so gullible to have come running after being fooled once. Now, whether or not you agree with that assessment, we almost certainly agree that had we been there, we would not have come running the third time. We aren't that naive or gullible to be fooled and lied to repeatedly. For sure, after the second time, just like the villagers, we'd have all caught on the shepherd boy was a liar. We're smart. Jews are smart, intelligent, sophisticated, most certainly not gullible fools. And yet, year after year, when we recall the Paro and Moshe saga, the contentious interaction and dialogue between Moses and Pharaoh, we focus in on and try and struggle to comprehend Paro's absurd stubbornness, his refusal to give in and let the Jews go despite plague after plague continuing to decimate his country. So much so that even some commentaries come and say it must be that Pharaoh had his free will suspended. No one could possibly be so foolish to let their country and people be destroyed by open miracles and plagues. However, if we think about it, almost, if not even more surprising than Paro's foolish stubbornness, is Moshe's seemingly incredible gullibility. Maka after maka, plague after plague against the Egyptians, Paro comes begging Moshe, "Oh, Moses, please, please, pray. Pray to God to have the plague go away. And I'll let you guys go afterwards." And Moshe always responds, "Sure, Paro, no problem. I'm happy to pray for you." And then without fail, every single time, after Moshe prays and the plague goes away, Paro changes his mind. "I'd actually rather the Jews stay." So maybe after the first one, Moshe shouldn't have known any better. But it happens over and over and over and over again. Paro repeatedly lies and tricks Moshe. He's being completely played for a fool. And this isn't just anybody being tricked. This is Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, one of the wisest people to ever live, an individual with incredible and profound wisdom, understanding of God, of the world, of humanity. And here he is being duped over and over again. Why was Moshe so gullible? What was he missing? What are we missing? I can still remember the moment under the crisp white chuppah at our wedding in Teaneck, New Jersey. My wife, you see her right there. When I uttered those special words, "Hare at mikudeshes li," "Behold, you are betrothed to me." And my wife lovingly took that ring and placed it on her finger. The rest of that story is our continuous unfolding history. However, as magical as that moment may have been for me and for my wife, it was actually quite simple. I asked her to be my wife, and she said yes. Pretty straightforward. However, the Talmud, the Gemara, and Maseches Kiddushin has a rather curious discussion as it wonders, what would have been the case if my betrothal formulation hadn't been so simple? What is the din? What is the Jewish law if I would have placed a condition on my proposal? Imagine if instead of just asking or saying, "Behold, you are my wife," I would have said, "Martha, behold, you are my wife on condition that you have blue eyes." Or what if I would have said, "Behold, you are my wife on condition that you have curly hair," or on condition that I have $10 million in my bank, or on condition I can bench press 300 pounds. What would be the case then? Does the betrothal work? So the Talmud responds and says, if one puts any of these kind of conditions on their marriage proposal, then the proposal is only valid if at the time of the proposal, those things are true. If I can bench press all that weight, which I can't, then great, I'd be married. But if not, then the marriage doesn't take effect. However, after discussing a series of these potential conditional marriage proposals, Talmud asks one more question that appears more perplexing and difficult to understand. What if someone says, "Hare at mikudeshali, behold, you are betrothed to me, almanas, on condition Sha'ani, that I am a tzaddik gemor, a perfectly righteous individual"? What is the halacha? What is the law in that case? Does that condition disqualify the proposal? Now, we would assume that the Talmud would say the same thing as it said previously. It should depend on whether I'm actually righteous. If I am, the marriage is good. And if not, then the marriage should be invalid. Now, granted, we can't know the inner righteousness of every person. But I'd venture to say that there are some people who, without a doubt, are clearly not righteous. If, God forbid, someone is a blatantly evil person, if they're cruel, heartless, and brutal to everyone around them, without a doubt, that marriage proposal should be invalid. However, to our utter shock, the Talmud says the marriage proposal is valid even if the person is a completely evil individual, a Rasha Gamor. And understanding and knowing that what was just stated sounds ridiculous and absurd, the Talmud proceeds to explain the reasoning why that proposal should still be good. And the Gemara says, because perhaps, maybe, in the moments right before he proposes and says, behold, you are my wife, on condition that I am totally righteous, maybe in those moments, maybe in the moments right before he says those words, he had Hirhuri Teshuva. It's possible that in his heart, in his mind, he repented from his prior ways. The Talmud declares that this is entirely conceivable, that even a Rasha Gamor, a completely evil person, in the moments right before he proposes, repented in his heart. It's plausible. He did a 180 and is now a perfectly righteous individual. And because of that, we assume that the marriage is in fact valid. Now, wait a second. Does this make any sense? Now, granted, we all may be born with this holy spark, with Kedusha inside of us. But wouldn't a lifetime of evil deeds extinguish the holy fire burning inside? Shouldn't it be impossible for someone like that to turn things around in a moment? Does the Talmud, does Judaism, does God really believe that a Rasha Gamor, a completely evil person, can transform his or herself into becoming a Tzadik Gamor, a righteous person, in just a few moments? Is that really true? And the answer is yes. Judaism proudly proclaims that no matter who you are, no matter what your background is, no matter your past deeds, even if one has led a life of complete evil, and all the more so anyone else, there is always still that spark of holiness inside. And if one puts their heart and mind to it, they can change. They can turn things around. They can lead a life of righteousness. No, Moshe wasn't gullible. Moses wasn't a fool. Moshe was a believer. He had a penetrating gaze. He saw beneath the surface. Moshe believed and understood that even someone as evil as Paro still had a spark of righteousness inside him. Beneath all the rubble of a life rampant with abuse and corruption, hidden beneath all that, there was still a glimmer of light, still a waning glow of goodness. And at any moment, Paro could tap into that. At any moment, Paro could change his entire life trajectory. He could repent. Paro was entirely capable of seeing the truth and realizing the evilness of enslavement and torture of the Jewish people. And Moses deeply believed that any moment Paro would, that he would repent and free the Jews. That was Moshe Rabbeinu. That was Moses. Someone on his level could do that, could see the spark even in a Rasha like Paro. But what about us? Is that relevant to us? In all likelihood, it's probably beyond us. Seeing the good in someone on Paro's level of evilness may be something impossible for us to do. But what about all the non-Paros in our lives? How do we perceive everyone else we interact with? Are we quick to write someone off the second they do something that offends us or sensitivities? Are we quick to put people we meet into boxes? He's like this, she's like that. Are we quick to grant guilty verdicts on those around us? Or do we have the patience to see beneath the surface of their external actions? Do we look for and focus on the good on all the people we meet? Are we able to see the flickers of holiness in everyone around us? Are we willing to put and risk our personal pride to see the good in someone else? Or are we too scared about the possibility of being fooled? And what about ourselves personally? How quick are we to judge ourselves? To tell ourselves, we can't do that mitzvah. We can't pray like that. I'm not holy enough. Look at me. I'm covered in schmutz and soot a lifetime. Judaism calls upon us to see beneath the surface, to peer beyond, both in ourselves and others, to see the Ner Tamid, the ever-burning fire inside all of us. I bless us that we should have that strength and patience of Moses to pry open our eyes to see the sparks of holiness in ourselves and everyone around us. Good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good Shabbos.
Shabbos, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good Shabbos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Wishing everyone a lovely, let me turn off the